Exactly. Okay, so the key thing that I want to talk about today is this little number, which I've entitled The Difference Between Political Communications and How Those Politics Are Communicated. It's a kind of handover from last week to a certain extent, but very much more up to date in terms of the themes and the lines that are coming through within that whole field. And is there a difference beyond obviously the most basic one in terms of how we could use the strap line that we can tell a politician's lying because their lips are moving, and so on and so forth? Or is there a way in which there's a kind of relevance to how these things operate? And how really politicians have used the mass media to get their own image across and their own messages across with varying degrees of success. And all of the campaigns that you've actually looked at possibly have elements which might and probably do have a sort of political aspect to that that can be sort of developed and discussed. One useful link is this particular thing. It's actually Italian-based, but you can use a translator thing to actually locate if it comes through. Maybe it already has, I just haven't realised that. Oops, yes it has. Because this is actually one of the sort of key areas which, certainly from a European perspective, opens up what Habermas would be delighted with. Because it's a way of actually discussing and talking about the whole notions of e-democracy and the areas that relate to that. And you can see it's obviously connected across the European situation. Whether it continues, of course, post-negotiations and so on is entirely up to yourselves, but not entirely up to the government or various other bits and pieces. But I thought it would be quite useful just talking a little bit about the whole essence of active citizenship, which is very much at the heart of becoming engaged with everything from UK food wastage to homelessness to climate change to any of those key aspects that are actually there. It's a way of actually sort of registering a whole aspect in a way which makes use of technology within the realm of what we would refer to as the public sphere. And I'll leave that for future reference from that point of view. But in addition to that, it's worthwhile noting some of the key areas relating to what we see within political communications. Because no matter what party you happen to be, there are a whole range of things, whether you're Labour, whether you're Conservative, whether you're Lib Democrat, whether you're Green, whatever the sort of line happens to be, there are certain party politics that come into play. And you're seeing it's used presently at Parliament, in which the range of party politics is very much causing differences. People are talking about a new seismic shift in politics, a change, a realignment, a kind of centre-right or centre-left policy and so on. All of that tends to kind of feed into the second of that particular list, which is pressure groups. That's effectively where aspects, topics and themes are being put together, and whether you're actually paid to be a lobbyist, to actually sort of bring them to attention of debating Parliament, etc. It's raising the profile. It's making people aware in the government, again, that sort of top of the tree in terms of the Habermas sort of list, that people are concerned about these things, whatever they happen to be. And every single one of the examples that you've just given in terms of topics that you're looking at would probably fit into to play in which questions can be asked, etc. That very cliched statement, questions will be asked, is really at the heart of democracy. You know, why is this going through, and so on. But I've separated the top three topics, or the top three names, really, from the bottom two, quite simply because there is a gap. Not just a pay gap, but also a gap between, obviously, discussing the actual issues in Parliament, in Westminster, in whichever particular organisation, country actually works through that, and certainly in Britain, the whole essence of a civil service. A civil service, as I'm sure you're aware, is not political. It specifically has to be apolitical, because its job is to simply enforce the views and the lines of the government in the day, and to ensure that these things become workable. Now, you can see a situation, if you look back over situation comedies, the old series Yes Minister, in which maybe you say, well, does that mean that the civil servants who are primarily unelected, they effectively sort of have a rule unto themselves that ultimately we become run by red tape, bureaucracy, and so on? Maybe to a certain extent we do. And again, that's another debate for another time, etc. Because it also leads on to this other question that kind of underpins those elements, which is, does that mean that all government communications, no matter how apparently impartial, are actually heavily politicised? You know, is it possible to actually have an apolitical government communications organisation? Or when you see Conservative response to Labour statements and vice versa, is that simply a case of you're seeing a different change in terms of how things are going? It's all under the umbrella of the top thing there, of political communications. Show of hands, anybody watch party political conferences? Oh, one. Oh. There was a time where actually a lot of people would have actually sort of tuned into that, but then there were lots of times where people wouldn't. Personally, I think seeing Theresa May break into an ABBA-oriented dance is probably one of the most fantastic sort of things of Western democracy that really could have wished for, really. Like, it paves the way for so many delightful things. Although it was debatable whether it was really an ABBA dance or a kind of Bride of Frankenstein kind of jerky robot, but that's by the by. Worthwhile looking up on YouTube if you wish. But even that, from the point of view of having a kind of image, a public relations spin, if you like, is all part and parcel of the message and the package that sort of goes together, as we'll see in a few moments. And things have changed consistently. If you look at political communications, that is one of Nagreen's comments from the back end of the 20th century, that actually what you should have in terms of political communication, ultimately, fundamentally, at its heart, should be modes of communication which enable citizens to live democratically. Which, again, on an ideal sense, you could say, of course. But then, is too much democracy bad for you? Do people want to engage as active participants in that democracy? Or is it a case of people who have the loudest voices, whether they're social justice warriors or whether they're right-wing reactionaries, will effectively sort of carry the state of play? You'd be seeing this in all of the campaigns that you're looking at in terms of what are the positives, what are the negatives, how are these messages getting across, and so on. I mean, just returning briefly to George's example of businesses post-Brexit. I mean, in the last few days, I've seen the Conservative Party saying, well, of course, it's very sad that these people are actually losing their jobs, but they're all skilled airline engineers, and they'll probably find good jobs in any case. Nothing to do with Brexit at all. And, of course, the flip side from the MEP. We said this is exactly what we said is going to happen. Who do you believe? Who do you work through that process, etc.? And does that ultimately help us make them more accountable for the things that they're actually doing? You know, whether or not you've actually voted, whether or not you've connected, how do you actually get those messages across there? And how do you actually address aspects which might be seen as problematic and difficult to work through? Okay, McNair's classic line here, and I haven't simplified it too much, but it shows the interrelationship and also, buzzword, I'd like to see this and mentioned in your presentations, the indeterminacy that we actually see in all of these aspects. And this model has changed. It's changed primarily because there's no place here really that talks about social media. The media that's referred to in this particular model is very much traditional mainstream media of radio, television, press. And it shows the way in which, in so many ways, there's a direction in which the media will give a whole range of editorials, reportage. This week we've heard that Andrew Neil is stepping down. We've also, Jeremy Paxton's gone. Are they going to be replaced by people who will hold people to account? Or has that time of questioning politicians kind of gone by the wayside? Or is Laura Koonsberg, and others, are they kind of ready to step up to the plate from that point of view? Because when you're within the media, you know, you do have a certain amount of power. And to quote the classic Stan Lee line, with great power comes great responsibility. Whether you actually have been bitten by a radioactive spider, or whether effectively you are commenting on society and saying these things are appropriate and not, as the case may be. Because guaranteed, these political organisations, parties, public organisations, pressure groups, yeah, even terrorists and governments, will pay attention to the media. They have to. They kind of use it themselves. You know, it was one of the things about the Arab Spring. It kind of was developed on social media. Whatever your viewpoint about the young girl who now wants to come back to Britain, I think it's quite sweet in a sense. It's a bit like a prodigal daughter, you know, but kill a fatted calf or various other. But in terms of that sort of perspective, you've got a whole range of issues relating to, should she come back? Well, she's had the baby. She went off to join ISIS. Is she without that? Where are we coming to on that basis? Really important. I mean, do you take a lie? Yeah, we'll take it back and then we'll put her in prison. Not good. How do you relate to the whole process? What sort of connections are actually there? It's a two-way process, certainly between how the media portrays that and those two sort of things. And equally, if you're looking at slightly more neutral, if there is such a thing as neutral lines relating to things like homelessness and so on, there'll be a range of programmes, appeals, advertising, of course public relations, in terms of raising that, whether it's the National Heart Foundation, or British Heart Foundation, whether it's, you know, whatever topic campaign you're sort of looking for. Then, of course, we have us in terms of the citizens. How can we engage in that if we're not part of the media bandwagon, if we're not part of the public relations machinery that's actually there, or if we're connecting with various other things? Well, you can use social media. You can also use a range of things that feed back to the media, that can be published by the media, and actually you can publish it yourself. That's why I say the fact that we haven't really included, or McNair didn't include, YouTube and podcasts and other sort of areas in that, which does open the way for the editorialisation to effectively be put to one side. You know, this is how vloggers operate. It's one of the reasons why you have a large number of YouTubers who will talk at length about how the BBC is a corrupt organisation that's basically become left-wing oriented and all the rest of its pieces, and so on and so forth. Likewise, there's this notion in terms of back to the media again, the notion of citizen journalism. It's a buzzword which used to be very popular 3 or 4 years ago. It's kind of fallen out of favour. Maybe because actually the dream of citizen journalism was that everybody reports on everything and we get a whole sort of range of perspectives, etc. True, the thing is, unless you've actually got some basic training and understand the way the system operates, you can literally be a voice crying in the wilderness. No matter how wonderful your blogs, letters to editors, and other opinion polls happen to be. But all of those things all fall under that banner of political communications between, in essence, the state, the public sphere, and the population. You can almost use them as synonymous in terms of aspects from that thing. So let's turn the clock back, not quite as far as we went last week with respect to the First World War, but to something which was happening at the height of the Suez Canal crisis. And 10 years after World War II had wrapped up. The Suez Canal crisis was arguably the time when Britain realised it was no longer an empire, because President Nasser of Egypt decided that he wanted to nationalise, or just decided to nationalise the Aswan, the dam that he was looking to build, etc. The Suez Canal was a critical part of world trade because it enabled oil to travel from the east to the west, from Arabia onwards, and it was hugely problematic. And Eden was faced with actually deciding, despite the fact that the Americans said no, that he wanted to send in the troops to sort out the Suez Canal crisis, supposedly supported by France, which he wasn't. So if we dial back to see how in 55 this was being portrayed and developed in YouTube, in the media, this is what hopefully we'll come up with.
There are now followers the second of the television election broadcast by the Conservative and Unionist parties. It is opened by the Prime Minister, the Right Honourable Sir Anthony Eden, KGMC.
Good evening. Tonight, 10 editors of leading newspapers from all over the country have kindly accepted my invitation to come and put questions to my colleagues and to me. We haven't, of course, the least idea what the questions are going to be. I only hope we shall know the answers. I have four colleagues here with me. On my right, Mr. Bartell, the Chancellor of the Exchequer.
Okay, so he's weeding out the big guns of the government. Chancellor of the Exchequer, we'll see where his other guests will be set. He's clearly setting the scene. You've obviously got due deference being given by the BBC towards the government of the day. And this is the time where effectively the journalists, as represented by the editors of the newspapers, will be questioning the politicians on behalf of the people. Does it work?
Next to him, Mr. McLeod, Minister of Health. On my left, the Foreign Secretary. And next to him, the Water Mountain Minister of Labour. Now, we are not going to introduce to you individually the editors, but their names will be flashed on the screen as they ask their questions. The BBC have also asked the editors to be good enough to stand up when they put their questions to make things easier for the viewer, and they've been good enough to agree to do so. Now, that's all the preliminaries there are. Could we have the first question,
please? Mr. Prime Minister, 80 years ago, the Northern Echo was saying the most shocking things about Disraeli, and it remains stoutly, though independently, liberal. Its readers would like to know what a returned Tory administration might do about the Liberal proposal that there should be a Royal Commission to inquire into the present position and functions of trade unions.
Mr. Gray, that's a considerable question covering wider areas of future policy. I think we're all conscious that there are problems to be dealt with there, but I'm not sure that the Royal Commission is the right body to do it. But perhaps the Walter Mountain Minister of Labour would have a word on that.
Yes, I should like to say this, that I hope and think that during the last 3.5 years, we've managed to get pretty good relationship with the trade union movement as a whole and the trade union leaders. And I'm quite sure that there are a great many problems in front of us now which we could help to solve if we sit down again together. Mm. Don't think the Royal Commission will necessarily help. I think they want to help me and I want to help them.
Next question, please.
Mr. Prime Minister, the Daily Mirror, which I represent, is not among your principal flatterers, but we have and always have had a high regard for your integrity. I would therefore be obliged if you personally would answer this question. During my time, there have been two sorts of Toryism. There is the Toryism of the small majority, that is, the Toryism of the welfare state. A more humanitarian form of Toryism than we've known before. In pre-war years, there was the Toryism of the big majority, the Toryism of neglected housing, neglected national defence, slums, and massive unemployment. You were a minister at that time, though not for the whole period, and therefore were responsible for, at any rate, a number of years of that regime. I would like to ask you, if you go back with a very big majority on May the 26th, what sort of Toryism can we expect from your government?
I hope and believe an intelligent, progressive Toryism tries to build Cardiff on the basis of what we've been doing in the last 3.5 years. And there's one amendment I would like to make to what you said about the pre-war period. I think our housing record in the pre-war period was a remarkable one. And it's made possible what we hope to.
Okay, I'm not going to go through the whole thing. You can always watch it if you wish it in your own time. But a few key things emerge from that. First of all, and obviously we're looking at this through the lens of over 70 years later, 80 years later. It's predominantly white male. Okay? They're very polite. Very polite. And the questions that, for instance, the Daily Mirror editor, Labour supporting Daily Mirror editor, Hugh Cudlip, sort of puts, it's almost a kind of, you know, with deference. So you've still got that sense of deference. Now, is that a bad thing? We're going to see in a few moments a different era, a different way in which we actually develop this kind of things. Or have we lost some of that respect? Something we'll talk about. Again, just bear in mind in terms of the sequences that we've actually got there. Okay, that. This. Because, of course, the other sort of key thing that when you start talking about this is people often hark back to a time and say, yes, people were much more politer then. It was a more friendly form of politics, a friendlier form of discussion, etc. There was a respect. Did that mean there was any change? Maybe. Maybe it was better. Again, something for discussion. So, you've had a look at Anthony Eden. Let's jump forward 50 years to Tony Blair. Let's see how he's actually being grilled by Jeremy Paxman on this edition of Newsnight, and compare and contrast with what we've actually just seen.
Good evening, welcome to a Newsnight special in which we'll be cross-examining the Prime Minister on the confrontation with Iraq. After yesterday's performance at the UN, America looks more...
First major difference, of course, he hasn't got three of his cabinet colleagues beside him at all. So this time it's Tony Blair just by himself representing the country as Prime Minister. And to quote himself when he was talking about the people's princess, perhaps the people's Prime Minister.
Determined than ever to go to war. Our government is George Bush's closest ally, yet many here and around the world would not believe the case for war has been made. Tonight, in the Baltic Centre in Gateshead, we've invited the Prime Minister to face an audience of ordinary people from here in the Northeast, all of whom are sceptical about the arguments for war with Iraq. Facing them is the Prime Minister. He's confessed himself worried he has not yet made the case for war. Tonight, taking questions from our audience and from me, he'll have the chance to do so. Prime Minister, for you to commit British forces to war, there has to be a clear and imminent danger to this country. What is it?
The danger is that if we allow Iraq to develop chemical, biological, nuclear weapons, they will threaten their own region. There is no way that we would be able to exclude ourselves from any regional conflict that was there, as indeed we had to become involved last time they committed acts of external aggression against Kuwait.
But right now there is no danger. It's a danger sometime in the future.
I've never said that Iraq's about to launch an attack on Britain, but if you look at the history of Saddam Hussein, there is absolutely no doubt at all that he poses a threat to his region. If he was to use chemical, biological, or nuclear weapons in the rest of his region, there is no way that Britain could stand aside from that, or indeed the rest of the world. And that's precisely why we've had 12 years of United Nations resolutions against it.
Well, you said of those UN resolutions and the sanctions that followed them in the year 2000, you said that they had contained him. What's happened since?
I didn't actually. I said they contained him up to a point. And the fact
is... Sorry, Prime Minister, we believe that the sanctions regime has effectively contained Saddam Hussein in the last 10 years.
So already you're getting a kind of you-are-a-liar, Prime Minister, approach coming across here in a way which is certainly a lot more aggressive, because the last one, of course, the conditions were being set by Harold Macmillan. Oh, not Harold Macmillan, by Anthony Eden and Harold Macmillan and the rest of them. They were effectively setting the agenda. Does this work? And, of course, here we've seen the ordinary people of Gateshead. Again, we'll see how they're brought in or not, as the case may be.
Said this one in November 2000.
Well, I can assure you, I've said every time I'm asked about this, they've contained him up to a point. And the fact is, the sanctions regime was beginning to crumble. It's why, it's subsequent, in fact, to that quote, we had a whole series of negotiations about tightening the sanctions regime. But the truth is, the inspectors were put out of Iraq, so we
had
no...
They were not put out of Iraq, Prime Minister. That is just not true. The weapons inspectors left Iraq after being told by the American government that bombs would be dropped on the country.
I'm sorry, that is simply not right. What happened is that the inspectors told us that they were unable to carry out their work, they couldn't do their work because they weren't being allowed access to the sites. They detailed that in the reports to the Security Council. On that basis, we said they should come out because they couldn't do their job properly.
That wasn't what
the
you
idea,
said. You said they were thrown out of Iraq.
Well, they were effectively because they couldn't do the work they were
effectively. They were not thrown out of Iraq.
No, I'm sorry, Jeremy. I'm sorry, Jeremy. I'm not allowing you away with that. That is completely wrong. Let me just explain to you what happened.
You've just said the decision was taken by the inspectors to leave the country. They were therefore not thrown out.
They were effectively thrown out for the reason that I will give you. Prior to them leaving Iraq, they had come back to the Security Council again and again and said, we're not being given access to sites. For example, things were being designated as presidential palaces. They weren't being allowed to go in there. As a result of that, they came back to the United Nations and said, we can't carry out the work as inspectors. Therefore, we said, you must leave because we will have to try and enforce this action a different way. So when you say the inspectors, when you imply the inspectors were in there doing their work, that is simply
not
the case.
That. I merely stated the fact that they were not thrown out, they were withdrawn, and you concede they were withdrawn.
They were withdrawn because they couldn't do their job. I mean, let's not be ridiculous about this. There's no point in the inspectors being in there unless they can do the job they're put in there to do. And the fact is, we know that Iraq throughout that time was concealing its weapons. Well, hang on, you say, Ryan, they were concealing their weapons. They lied about both the existence of their nuclear weapons program and their biological weapons program. And it was only when people were interviewed, when they defected from the Iraqi regime and were interviewed, that we discovered the existence, full existence, of those programs at all.
Has not Colin Powell demonstrated yesterday, quite conclusively, that a regime in which those weapons inspectors are back in Iraq is one in which it is impossible for Saddam Hussein to continue developing weapons of mass destruction?
No, because what he is doing is engaging in a systematic campaign of concealment. And what Colin Powell was doing yesterday was giving evidence, for example, intelligence evidence and other evidence of direct conversations, which are evidence of the concealment that's happening. We still don't know, for example, what has happened to the thousands of litres of botulin and anthrax that were unaccounted for when the inspectors left in 1999. So, you know, the idea that...
So you believe American intelligence?
Well, I do actually believe this intelligence.
There's a lot of dead people in an aspirin factory in Sudan who don't.
Well, come on. This intelligence is backed up by our own intelligence. And in any event, you know, we're not coming to this without any history. I mean, let's not be absurdly naive about it.
Hans Blixer saw no evidence of hiding of weapons.
I'm sorry, what Hans Blixer said is that the Iraqis are not cooperating properly.
Hans Blix said he saw no evidence either of weapons manufacture or that they had been concealed.
No, I don't think, again, that is right. I think what he said was that the evidence that he had indicated that the Iraqis were not cooperating properly and that, for example, he thought that the nerve agent, VX, may have been weaponized.
Okay, so we've gone long over the time where actually in the Eden's Day you had two members of the press who actually put questions in there. Because you've got this basically duel and challenge and battle of the gladiators between Jeremy Paxman obviously driving home the notion that Tony Blair's a liar, which again we would find out would probably be the case because there were no weapons of mass destruction. But you've also got the notion of a conviction politician. Interesting enough, I mean, it's always interesting to look back on hindsight. It's a period of time when I believe Tony Blair was saying he was actually felt on a divine mission to kind of work through this, so it had voices as well from that point of view. But still, of course, no ordinary members of the public are allowed to engage in this. You've got a two-way process between the media and the government. Is that democracy?
Also said that the discovery of the warheads might be, I think I'm quoting here, maybe the tip of an iceberg. I think you'll find that in that report.
You produced a dossier last September in which you outlined Iraq's alleged weapons of mass destruction. All the sites in that report were visited by UN inspectors who found no evidence of weapons or no evidence of their having been hidden.
I'm sorry, it is absolutely clear what has been happening over the past few months, which is, of course, I mean, the moment we mentioned those in our intelligence reports, we were aware of the fact that the Iraqis would then have a significant period of time in which they could conceal these weapons. But, you know, if this were some country that we have no history of this problem with, and this was the first time anyone had ever raised the issue, there might be a point in what you're saying. It is absurd in the case of it. I don't concede it's true at all. It is absurd to say in a situation where Iraq has definitely had these weapons, developed them over a long period of time, concealed them, that there is nothing to be suspicious of when they can't even account for the weapons that we know were there when the inspectors left in 1999.
Right, let's hear from our first member of the audience. Leslie Farrell, what do you make of the evidence?
I do think there's sufficient evidence at the moment. When Mr. Bush yesterday come up with this agreement, supposed to be new evidence, I don't think there was anything there.
Well, what there was evidence. I mean, look, this is what our intelligence services are telling us, and it's difficult because, you know, either they're simply making the whole thing up, or this is what they're telling me as the Prime Minister, and I've no doubt what the American intelligence are telling President Bush as well, and that is that there are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. We know they were there before, that the Iraqis are now trying to conceal those, that although they're allowing the inspectors access to sites, they're not actually fully cooperating with inspectors. For example, they're not allowing the experts who worked on these programs to be interviewed properly by the inspectors. And what Colin Powell was talking about at the UN yesterday was the systematic attempt to try and conceal this, to disperse it into the country so that it couldn't be found by the inspectors. So we're faced with a situation where, I mean, here lies the Prime Minister, this is the evidence that's coming to me, day in, day out, and I think it would just be wrong of us and irresponsible of me not to act on that. Now, if Iraq wanted to cooperate with the weapons inspectors, they could do it perfectly easily. They could say, here are all the experts that worked on our program, come and interview them, free from Iraqi minders, not in designated places. This is what's happened to the stuff that was left over from the inspectors before. If they did all that, they would be cooperating, and I agree with you, it would be a different situation.
Until come America's got spy satellites, and you're constantly picking anything up.
Well, they are, of course, picking things up. What,
they're not seeing any mass weapons up of anything on them?
Well, they're
it's interesting, obviously you can almost see a subtext to the terrible practice saying, oh, what a wonderful, quaint, Geordie person asking these wonderful, quaint, Geordie questions. Again, it's feeding in to that whole notion of how we're seeing this debate being framed, how it's being put together, and obviously the huge indeterminacy, the fact we don't really know what's taking place in any case. Now, there is an argument of saying this 2003, which was kind of like a foundation, which paved the way for fake news, Donald Trump, Brexit, and so on. Because people actually realise, actually, if you can just start telling the lie often enough, there are weapons in Iraq, there are weapons in Iraq, let's go to war with Iraq, because there are weapons in Iraq, let's go to war with Iraq, because they're nasty people, because they need to have weapons, etc. That actually you get to this sort of stage of thinking, well, where does the debate come in? And again, you know, I'm not going to do the whole thing, but we're about a roughly over 10% into the extra 15% into the programme. In terms of content analysis, the bulk of the speech has still been coming from the Prime Minister. Paxford's obviously given his routine. I think we'll allow one last question, hopefully, before we sort of head off to the next stage.
Certainly, movements of material, and one of the things that Colin Powell's talking about this day is the movement of material shortly before an inspection took place. So, you know, you've got to put it all together and make a judgment.
This is the gentleman next to you.
Prime Minister, you must see the evidence that was presented yesterday as laughable. It was Morecambe Wise-esque. The warhead sketch. It was just absolutely laughable what Colin Powell put in front of the UN.
It's interesting, Leslie is just ordinary citizen. This chap is a liar, but that's why they're lying.
Well, I don't think it was laughable at all.
That's your point of view. The Prime Minister has said that he accepts the evidence. Monica Frisch.
Well, can I just deal with this for a moment? Look, leave aside what's been happening in the last few months and all the debate about whether we have a war in Iraq or not. I mean, you wouldn't dispute with me that this is a barbaric and appalling regime.
Well, I would say to you, Prime Minister, that the war is to get rid of a despotic dictator who has no real democratic mandate, who's very destabilising, who commits human rights violations. Is Mr. Bush next, perhaps?
Well, what you think Saddam's the same as George Bush?
I'm saying Mr. Bush has a lot of comparisons.
I think that's a bit unfair. Right. I don't think George
Bush is. Just as well, Donald Trump isn't around there. Okay, we'll take this one last one.
I'm
totally opposed to anyone having or developing nuclear weapons. But that goes for British and American nuclear weapons as well. This country has lots of nuclear weapons. The United States has nuclear weapons. The United States has dropped nuclear bombs. Don't let us forget that. How can we possibly justify criticising Iraq for developing nuclear weapons when we're doing so little to get rid of our own? Isn't it incredibly hypocritical?
Prime Minister?
I don't believe so for two reasons. First of all, we're obviously part of a whole lot of agreements to do with nuclear weapons. Secondly, Britain has not menaced and used external aggression with these types of weapons against our neighbours. You know, Saddam, every time he has been allowed to do so, has started a war with the countries around him. He used chemical weapons against the Iranians some years ago.
Such a pity he was actually such friends with the CIA then, wasn't it? But still, that's another little line. It's interesting in terms of, again, the way that the debate is being phrased and the way in which the presentation, the re-presentation, repackaging is being phrased, because, again, it's addressing the same sort of issues about fake news, possibly, that we've come to know and love so well today with a whole variety of other bits and pieces. And also the shock of, we would never use weapons. It reminded me slightly, again, of the recent sort of line that we were so shocked as a country, apparently, that Donald Tusk had dared to say that there's a cold circle in hell awaiting people who voted for Brexit without any plan, etc. Because, of course, in Britain, we never use lines in our newspapers like, up yours, Delors, you are rats, and various other bits and pieces. It's just not part of our equality at all, really. So I think source for the goose, gander, and various other bits and pieces spring to mind. Anyway, I'm neutral on this, so let's go back to the actual sort of package. Again, leave it to yourself to actually determine the similarities and differences and whether one is preferable to the other. I mean, you might well say, actually, you'd prefer to have at least a kind of unified cabinet front with three or four people actually talking to a group of professional journalists and so on. Or maybe, again, it's important to have Stop the War Coalition represented as well as lawyers and random token Geordies, much as we love them all. In other words, you're getting back to this line that McNair talks about in terms of how these things get across. And this is a key public relations element from that in terms of PR in the public sphere. It doesn't matter how much you spend on the message if the audience isn't buying into it, it's not going to succeed. This was really at the heart of that piece we watched a couple of weeks ago when you saw the dramatisation of how take back control was the simple message that was pumped out there as a way forward. And it's one of those areas where I think one needs to be very careful about what simple messages you get there. Sometimes a simple message does the job because you're looking for a campaign for the British Heart Foundation or for homeless, to end homelessness, etc. But other times, maybe again, we just need to look through that because it's dealing with target audiences, it's dealing with who's connecting with that whole field, and so on. And certainly, if we talk about quality in inverted commas, let's go back a little bit more to John Major, 1990, when Margaret Thatcher was effectively booted out of office by her fellow Conservative Party. Major took over, and as he said on the first cabinet meeting, allegedly, well, who'd have thought it? Look at this one from the point of view of the election campaign that nobody actually expected him to actually win, and the sort of message that he's actually sending out to the electorate as a Conservative Prime Minister and leader as well, from that point of view. One of Brixton's finest. Epic, the journey.
I spent most of my youth in South London until well into my 30s at different houses. It was a very vivid area. It's never dull, it's always changing. It has a tremendous vibrancy that very few parts of the country understand. And yet there is an innate friendliness in the area that those people who live there understand very well. Can we turn left into Atlantic Road in the moment, please? I think I might go down there and have a look. This is really the heart of it. Once you come down the main road, turn left into the market. It's where Brixton takes its heart. Everybody who lives in and around the area is familiar with Brixton Market, goes there, shops there.
You have a pound of those tomatoes? We used to come in and buy kippers.
Well, we're still selling kippers and that's the kippers.
When I was in my early teens, I used to occasionally erect a soapbox. I had two soapboxes, one that I used to erect in Brixton Market and the other in Brixton Road, and I used to talk about political matters of the day, and everyone was very tolerant. Sam used to listen. Sam used to engage in that. Lots of other people smiled cheerfully and moved on. But it was a very good experience.
We used to play in my shop, that shop in the corner. The record shop used to come to. Yes.
This is Cold Park Lane, all these old houses with the basements down there. And the Enterprise pub, which has been there as long as I can recall. And here's Eastgate Road, and that's the house we lived in for many years. Behind there in Eastgate Road, we had a wicket pitched on the wall of the houses opposite. We used to play cricket up against it for hours on end. I think it's a fallacy for people to think that because of my background and where I came from that I should be a socialist. Why should I be a socialist? It is people in that background who have actually suffered most from the fact that we've had a society in which the free enterprise system moved ahead and then was blocked as one moved over the years from conservative governments to socialist governments. When I was in my mid-teens, we moved to Burton Road. When you see the house ahead with the two white arches, immediately opposite there.
Okay, so on the one hand, you might say, that was John Major, fundamentally decent bloke. He decided to actually pursue a particular line and work through that. Or you can say, it's a hell of a manipulative series of images there, in terms of how to tap into the residents of Brixton, folk with respect to that, to say he's just an ordinary folk, etc. Push comes to shove, I'd probably take him over Tony Blair, but that's by the by. But again, it's getting that message across in terms of how identity. I mean, it's interesting, Major's very much one of the Remainers, or was one of the Remainers, from that point of view. But it's pushing an image. It's putting an image which actually proved to be very successful up until, obviously, divisions in Europe, etc., did for the whole sort of package, and New Labour obviously took over. So this whole premise of setting the agenda, again, sort of citing from McNair, is essential to kind of the where PR fits into this. Because I think we're being very naive if we don't take on board the line that's stated in that. No, the media effectively is where we find out stuff. Now, if we're doing our job, hopefully, or we're conscious of that, we'll check our sources. We won't accept everything that we're actually given. But it also has its own agenda as well. Paxman had his own agenda in Newsnight. So do a whole range of other. It's inevitable. It's part and parcel of that whole thing. And whether something's talked about right at the start or right at the end kind of sits where you're looking at the importance. What was the first thing I launched the session with today? I wanted to find out exactly what your topics were going to be, because that actually is the key and important part of this particular session, to actually get you thinking about those kind of things and working through that. I'm not giving this a lesser importance, but I am saying use some of this to underpin some of the kind of critical theory in terms of when you're analysing your campaigns, when you're looking at the way that things are working. Judicious quotes like this, or something similar to it, can sometimes be the difference between getting a first and getting a low 2-2 or something. You know, don't describe that whole line. I've often said, analyse, don't just describe. Put more sort of reasons why these things are actually happening and how things are developing. When we talk about agenda setting, again, sort of following through from that point of view. Work with the media, but don't trust them. There is this challenge if you're in a political party. Actually, it doesn't have to be a political party. Any organisation. Oxfam found this last year when you have embarrassing revelations about characters connected with the system in terms of what's happening. Now, you should say it's shining the light of truth and light on the whole thing, or it's causing a huge embarrassment for the company. How do you actually cope with that whole process? And how, again, do you actually sort of manage the media and manage the social media? Well, actually, as we know, you can't really do that effectively, or can you? We're talking now, and Parliament is actually talking about ways in which social media would be subject to the same conditions that print media are subject to, in terms of libel, in terms of slander, in terms of accuracy and so on. They've been talking about that for the last 10 years, actually. If we do switch to that thing, then it becomes a different area when you start seeing it's something which we've always counseled students about. Be careful what you post on your social media sites, because you are publishing it. They are accessible. You can work through that process. It's worth sort of bearing that in mind, no matter how free-spirited you might seem. But then, you see, the flip side of it is, well, do you want a society that's that controlled? You know, maybe a bit like China-ish, where you actually feel that you can't literally just have a spontaneous like or dislike or retweet or whatever. Again, it's interesting thing we'll talk about, let's say, in a few moments. Because that is at the heart of that question. And if we were talking with Habermas at present, you know, he would probably say, of course it is. But is that mass media input ultimately what gives us the sort of chance to speak about things and talk about things and find out? Because, you know, to the vast majority of people, go back to the Iraq War, didn't impact them. I mean, I don't know if anybody in this room knew anybody who went over there and was waiting for the whole thing, but, you know, broadly speaking, it was something which was a war that took place over there, and we spent a lot of money on it, and we found it was a complete farce because, all right, well, Saddam Hussein was deposed and then executed. But other than that, what did it actually do? I mean, the line at the time was, well, why didn't we do this with Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe? Answer, there wasn't much oil in Zimbabwe. Ultimately, again, bear in mind some of the caveats of this. And again, this comes from McNair's sort of line, etc. That if you are user-generating content, if you are putting stuff out there, then clearly, as Jeff Bezos, as Mark Zuckerberg, as Sergey Brin, etc., would actually say, you know, yeah, it is impacting in terms of how things are going. Whereas old media doesn't really operate on that premise. You know, even now, the whole notions of the editors of newspapers, the editor of Newsnight, the BBC, ITV, CNN, Fox News, they're kind of using the traditional sort of ways forward. Although they are looking very much for interactivity and so on, hence BBC Sounds. Great way of accessing all sorts of podcasts. Okay, talking about podcasts and such like, do we remember Nick Clegg? He's in charge of Facebook now, certainly Facebook's sort of public impressions and so on. This was obviously the response that was put up when, of course, he was forced into noting the fact that despite claiming that the Liberal Democrats, if they went into coalition with the Tories, would not be seeking any student fees whatsoever. Of course, that didn't choose. That wasn't the case. And this is the part of the response that maybe was even more impressive.
I'd like to take this opportunity to put a few things straight. When I meet people around the country, it's obvious that many of you have strong and pretty mixed reactions to some of the things that Liberal Democrats have done in government. Many of you tell me that you're glad that at a time of real economic uncertainty, you put aside our political differences to provide our country with stable leadership. But I also meet people who are disappointed and angry that we couldn't keep all our promises. We couldn't keep all our promises, above all our promise not to raise tuition fees. And to those people, I say this. We made a promise before the election that we would vote against any rising fees. We would vote against any rising fees. We would vote against any rising fees. It was a pledge made with the best of intentions. The best of intentions. But we shouldn't have made a promise we weren't absolutely sure we could deliver. I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm so, so sorry. There's no easy way to say I'm sorry, I'm sorry.
But his career is going okay since then, so all's well with the world. Satire is one of the most effective ways still, and obviously whether you use auto-tune or various other factors, of raising kind of profiles, issues, and other elements. And it shouldn't be underestimated how impactful satire can actually be, because in many ways it opens up the debate to how people think, you know, whether it is, say, it's of leaders, Jeremy Corbyn, and otherwise. And it also brings into question this A word, that whole essence of how truthful are our leaders, how authentic are they? It's something that Hollywood talks about a great deal with directors who talk about they want the authentic incarnation of this particular role and so on. And what McNair's saying in this particular quote is very much that somehow you can define a socialist and you can define a capitalist in easy, nice, biteable terms. Well, maybe that's not the case. People tend to blur in terms of various other things. You know, the majority of the Labour Party, it would seem, would be in favour of remaining in Europe. Jeremy Corbyn quite clearly isn't. And never has been, actually, because he'd much rather have relations with China. And you know, so there are a whole range of other sort of elements within the viewpoint that comes through on that side of things. And indeed, the very election of Corbyn as the Labour leader kind of had knock-on effects because, you know, it was deemed that he was unelectable. And there were sort of issues with, I mean, compare, in a sense, Corbyn with Tony Blair, huge, huge differences in terms of the notion of authentic images and elements within that. But then Alistair Campbell, when he was press secretary with respect to Tony Blair, would say he wasn't a corporate to do with image making or shallow image making. He was much more like the whole person. Well, spin doctors and PR specialists are at the heart of this as well. So, and maybe have to take some responsibility for that whole notion of how politics are communicated and so on.